In less than 3 hours, Donald Trump will become the 45th president of the United States. More violence, striking at a busy downtown Jacksonville event, and it's the end of an era for a local family-owned publication. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9 on the radio. Also, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, we speak with newly sworn-in Clay County Sheriff Daryl Daniels and his plans for Clay County public safety. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday, and it's also Inauguration Day in this country. As we look at the top stories of the week, we welcome A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Good morning.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Andrew Pantazzi, reporter at the Florida Times-Union.
Good morning.
And our regular contributor, Fred Matthews.
Good morning.
Great to see you. Thanks, everyone, for being here, and lots to discuss this Friday, including another shooting incident in downtown Jacksonville and some interesting bills we are going to talk about moving in the Florida legislature and more news and notes from the week. But our top story, after a long and often bitter campaign and a controversial transition period, Donald Trump will become the 45th president of the United States when he takes the oath of office today at noon. You can tune into live coverage of the inauguration beginning at 11 a.m. this morning here on 89.9 FM. And here's our question to callers. What are your hopes or concerns regarding the new administration? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. Let's begin with you, Claire Goforth. You are actually traveling to Washington, D.C. to take part in the Women's March on Washington, which will take place tomorrow after the inauguration.
Yes, that's correct. I'm actually covering it. I'm not taking
You're not
part
taking
in the
part.
March.
You're covering
yes,
it.
I'm covering it in my capacity as the editor of Folio Weekly, and we'll be covering it via social media and in next week's edition. I don't know really what to expect. I think a lot of people are wondering whether or not they're going to be there will be greater attendance at tomorrow's events than there will be today. That is what a lot of the rumors are. I mean, our nation is deeply divided at this time, and I think a lot of us are sitting back and wondering, where do we go from here? Is Donald Trump going to unite us in some way, or is he going to further divide us?
And President-elect Trump, AG, has promised to hit the ground running, signing his first executive orders within hours of taking the oath of office. His big priorities, trade deals, the rolling back of regulations, in particular in the energy sector, and repealing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare.
Right. And, you know, those can be taken of a piece. I mean, the Obamacare process is going to be more complicated than just repeal and replace. There are senators like Ron Johnson, a Republican of Wisconsin, that's saying that this stuff is so entrenched that if you're going to reform the law, you have to do it piece by piece. You can't do an omnibus. But a lot of the Trump agenda comes straight from the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank up in Washington, D.C. So, you know, things like rolling back regulation, things like cutting National Endowment for the Arts, cutting funds for public broadcasting, and so on. You know, these have all been on the conservative wish list for a long time. The George W. Bush administration obviously didn't do most of this stuff despite worries, but, you know, Donald Trump is less encumbered by, you know, establishment strictures, and, you know, you might want to watch that first 100 days because those executive orders are going to be legit.
And we want your calls about the new administration and the top stories of the week at 549-2937. Fred Matthews, Andrew Pantazzi, as Donald Trump takes the oath of office, there are multiple espionage investigations going on among a variety of different intelligence agencies looking into the president and his team's alleged ties to Russia. As that is happening, we are going to witness historic protests in the nation's capital. Some 200,000 people show up to protest Trump's election. All of this taking place, as Claire said, with a nation so divided over this transition process as we go from President Barack Obama to President Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think this will be interesting. We're obviously going into a historic presidency that's going to be drastically different than any we've seen before, or at least that's how it has looked throughout the campaign and in the transition period. Who was it, the president, that said, when you have public opinion for you, you can do anything. When you have public opinion against you, you can do nothing. I think Donald Trump is going to try to show a way that goes against that, saying you don't need to win people over from the other side. You just need to get your people elected, and then when they're in office, willing to do what you say. I mean, I guess he's really trying to reimagine the bully pulpit through Twitter and through the use of calling people out name by name of his own party, threatening to run people against chairs of state parties like he did in Ohio, where he was successful, or threatening to primary senators who don't fall in line.
Well, it will be interesting to see if those remaining members in top positions of the CIA and FBI, DNI, if in fact they have any information that they will be able to use. The question here will be that even if the information were to bubble up, the CIA director is outgoing, so there's going to be a new person in his place. The FBI director doesn't have the kind of stature that he might have had in the Clinton administration, but and of course, we have a Congress who may not even be willing to take these matters up in a hearing. The Democrats will simply have to have their own miniature hearing to hear any of this, to give it any public hearing. We cannot depend upon the Republican majority to take these any hearings up on any of these national security matters. That would reflect badly on the Trump administration and thus them very seriously. So, but we've gotten the government that we elected. That's always the case. This is really change that many people can believe in. And you're right. Starting this afternoon and on into the weekend, we'll see the first set of executive orders come through. He has promised us a new plan for Obamacare once his HHS secretary gets approved. And that will be one of the bigger things that we'll be looking out for, to see how his repeal and replacement plan is going to work.
How will that work in terms of the fact that Donald Trump has pledged that no one will go without insurance? The AG, the Congressional Budget Office, warned this week that partial repeal without some sort of replacement will leave tens of millions of people uninsured and cause a spike in insurance premiums. So I think there's so much curiosity and anxiety, too, about what we're going to see from the new administration in terms of health care.
Yeah, and Governor Rick Scott has actually been helping Donald Trump come up with the plan. And Scott's comments have said that he wants to see more decision-making to the states because he believes the states can make decisions better than the federal government can on a one-size-fits-all level. So what would that look like? You might see block grants going to the states and to administer their own programs instead of federally administered program. Will that be more efficient or not? The devil's in the details, but that seems to be where it's moving, and there's not going to be any meaningful resistance in Congress for a plan like that.
I don't know that that's true about meaningful resistance, because what we're seeing is progressive groups are using that indivisible guide to take a page from the Tea Party's playbook and try to utilize that tactic with a small core group of people to be extremely vocal and extremely engaged on a variety of issues. And yesterday I spent some time with a group from Nassau County who came down. They had an appointment at Marco Rubio's office, and then they had an appointment at Bill Nelson's office, our senators at their local offices, to talk to staffers to address their specific concerns with the incoming administration and its policies. So while it may be true that for now Donald Trump and the Republican Congress, they are carrying the day, if you see core voters just continuously hammering at their representatives, it can be quite effective, as we have seen in the past.
I think what Claire is saying is a really good point. When you have 8 years of a Democratic administration, there's a sense in which Democrats lose the ability to organize and Republicans gain that ability. And then when the party switches, it's how quickly can the Democrats relearn their organizing skills and start bringing together either protests or just going to the representatives and bringing forward this massive bringing forward their opinion to their representatives and their senators. And I think that we are already seeing Democrats trying to relearn how to say we disagree with what the incoming administration is going to implement.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. In a few hours, Donald Trump will take the oath of office and become the 45th president of the United States. Are you excited about the new administration? Are you unhappy with the changes we're about to see? We want your calls either way. Give us a call at 549-2937 Laplace. Is it Laplace in Atlantic Beach? Good morning.
Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Melissa. I voted for Hillary Clinton, but last night I had a conversation with an old gentleman who's 83 years old and a professional, retired professional. He grew up in Harlem, New York. I mean, he grew up and he has his life is just a history lesson. He knew Martin Luther King Jr. and had long conversations with him. He knew Malcolm X, had long conversations with him. I mean, they knew him. Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis, these are people who he affiliated with. And yet, this man, who even in Jacksonville, he came to Jacksonville. We had a long conversation. He came to Jacksonville in the late 50s from New York and got locked up with his wife because they didn't want to sit in the back of a bus. But this man voted for Donald Trump. He voted for Donald Trump because he thought that DC needed a shakeup, and one who equates voting for Donald Trump with Confederate flags, because I would see people driving along the roads here with Confederate flags and Trump stickers on their back, on the back of their bumper. I just listened to it, and I just wanted to know if you would comment on that. That's it. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Laplace. Okay, so very interesting call from that listener when he talked about his acquaintance's reason for voting for Donald Trump, the idea that Donald Trump will shake up Washington.
A lot of people are expecting him to, maybe for the better, maybe for the worse. I mean, Washington has become the cesspool. There's certain truth to him calling it the swamp, but it does function. And, I mean, that's the government that we have, so I'm not sure that the people who represent us in Congress are actually looking forward to this draining of the swamp.
Yeah, I covered a campaign closely, obviously, like everybody at this table. And, you know, we saw the conflation of Donald Trump support and Confederate flags and all of that. If you went to the rallies, you couldn't have missed it. But, you know, the change narrative, you have to look at it in the context of that campaign because, you know, Hillary Clinton was defined as being a creature of the establishment, you know, the Clinton Foundation taking money from all over the world and, you know, deals being struck. And, you know, Trump played on that narrative. You know, however, that narrative is not going to be available for Donald Trump to use. It's not going to be like Lenny Curry talking about Alvin Brown for 2 years after, you know, he becomes mayor. It's more like, okay, you're in the office, you know, let's see what you can do. And, you know, he's got to show results. And, you know, going back to what Andrew and Claire said before, I mean, yeah, there is going to be real protest. There is going to be real mobilization on the popular level. And, you know, Trump's going to have to ameliorate that or else it's going to be an ugly midterm election.
Derek on the north side. Go ahead, Derek.
So I just had a comment that I saw on Facebook yesterday and really helped me to accept the whole Trump presidency thing. You know, today we're not crowning a king. We're not worshiping our dictator. We're hiring a king. You know, it doesn't matter if you like him or not. He's only going to be around for a little while. Let's deal with what it is.
All right, thanks, Derek. Lots of calls if you're just tuning in to our Friday roundtable. What are your thoughts about the new Trump administration? The president-elect will take the oath of office in just a few hours. Nell is down in St. Augustine. Hey, Nell, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. The reason I'm calling is that tomorrow in St. Augustine, there will be a rally called Unity in Community, where people will be gathering on the east side of the Bridge Alliance starting at noon. At 1 o'clock, there'll be a march across the Bridge Alliance to the Plaza de la Constitución, and there will be music with the peace mix. There will be a number of speakers who will be talking on issues. We want to make this positive, and we want to make it something that these are issues that we think are important, and we hope that people will basically try and keep the good things that we have and work towards the things that would improve our community.
Okay. Thanks, Nell, for letting us know that. I've also been asked to mention a big rally expected with hundreds of people in Fernandina Beach Saturday. There will be a rally in downtown Jacksonville, which will start at the Evergreen Cemetery. A suffragette is buried there, Mary Nolan. She was instrumental in the fight for women to earn the right or to win the right to vote. They will go from the cemetery to the Jacksonville Landing. Some multiple rallies going on tomorrow, in addition to the big one in D.C. Andrew, lots of local events happening.
Yeah, no, I didn't realize about the rallies that were happening locally tomorrow. But I think it's not surprising. And as Claire and I said earlier, I do think this is an event where Democrats need to hit the ground running quickly. If you are someone who is upset with the incoming administration, learning what actions you can take to make your voices heard, I think Republicans have done a fairly extraordinary job of that over the last 6 years, making sure that they were constantly organizing and protesting the current president for the next couple of hours or next hour or so, in voicing their displeasure with his policies. I think starting off this weekend protests like that makes sense.
A couple of tweets from listeners. Here's one from Josh. Irrespective of anyone's views on @RealDonaldTrump, that's his Twitter handle, of course. Today marks the biggest test of our democratic institutions in decades. Here's one from Kingsley. Can the panel take a realistic stab at what good Trump could do in 4 years for the nation? As skeptical as I am, she writes.
I'll take a start. I mean, you know, you'll see more realistic trade deals. You see more realistic business negotiations. Trump will have better liaisons with CEOs, which could lead to more domestic production of consumer goods, flipping the export-import balance. I mean, these are things you can actually look forward to. You know, I'm not expecting much on civil liberties or anything like that. But, you know, in terms of the economics, you're also going to see, an expansion in money supply, which is going to lead to short-term gains in people's pocketbooks, sort of like you saw the last 8 years. You're going to see all these tricks come out. But, you know, here's the reality. I mean, you're going through a quarter century of American decline. You know, you've got a situation where, you know, let's say Obama was Gorbachev, you know, Trump could be Yeltsin. You know, what comes next? The American Putin. So you know, that's sort of the cautionary tale, which is we're on a long descent toward, you know, economic dislocation and the kind of enforcement mechanisms that come with it. But there will be some short-term good before that happens.
And if you're just tuning in, we're going to move on as we talk about the top stories of the week. As a reminder, 89.9 will carry live coverage of the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump starting at 11 a.m. this morning. The number to join us as we talk about other stories, though, is 549-2937. And sad to see that right after or a few hours after the Martin Luther King Day parade Monday in Jacksonville, shots rang out in front of the Jacksonville Landing. A 16-year-old boy was killed, another 13-year-old injured. Police say it may be gang-related and connected to another shooting incident 2 weeks ago at Art Walk. It has renewed concerns about public safety, Fred and Claire, in downtown Jacksonville, as the sheriff's office and city officials try to reassure people that downtown is safe and you should keep coming downtown.
Yeah, I mean, downtown statistically is one of the safer parts of the city. People's perception is, I think, temporarily skewed right now because of the shootings. And, I mean, the second one in broad daylight, that was quite shocking. That was a blow to a community. I don't know that the teens that they say are involved are active participants in the gang. We have to take the sheriff's word on that. And I know that there were, you know, the young victim's mother was quite distraught at that association.
Right. And we're also hearing Fred and Andrew, the owner of the Landing, Tony Slaman, says he may ban groups of teens from the Landing younger than 21.
I think he's on the right track. He probably should have been doing this all along. Look, all across this community, if you're under 21, you're probably not going to get in very many places, especially if there's even a hint of alcohol legally. But what the club owners have learned is that when you have people under the age of 21 or 19 able to come into the place, you're going to inevitably have problems. The other part of this is that the sheriff has got to be a little come a little cleaner with the information that he has or that he doesn't have. We've had a gang task force in Duval County almost for the last 20 years when this first reared its head. Before, they used to paste all the pictures on a wall down there. You could see who led what and all of that. Now all of that is computerized. You can click on Facebook right now with the name of that kid who got shot and maybe and whoever was next to him, and you can see all of their feeds with guns, without guns, what their new nicknames is. It's no longer just the sheriff's office has access to this. Any of us can have access to it just by clicking on their name, clicking on their friends. If you have access to that, imagine what the sheriff's office has access to. And we've been talking and talking and talking about infiltration of gangs and all of that, and still nothing, and this happens. This is one of those instances in which, just like with the shooting at the art walk issue, that wasn't related to the art walk. It was related to something that was happening that started a neighborhood and blossomed downtown. This is one of those preventative issues that people assume the sheriff's office will do. But the sheriff's office, is the first duty is not necessarily prevention of crime. And that's the point that we all as citizens get caught up with. It's not their job to prevent crimes. Theirs is to arrest and investigate.
But that said, certainly the onus is on the sheriff and the mayor who campaigned on a platform of public safety. Let's be clear. that is a core function of government, public safety. And concerns remain that we do not have a good handle on our public.
But they will,
safety
put that
in
back,
downtown Jacksonville.
They will put that, but they've in each case. Put
and
that
you brought
back
that up
community.
The last time you were on this roundtable. By the way,
I did, and regretfully, we've seen some incidents that sort of prove my point. You know what we saw with the art walk. And with this latest incident on MLK Day, you know, you're seeing people coming from other parts of town, and you know they're bringing the violence to the landing, and that's what's so shocking. Because if this stuff happens on Cleveland Road, yeah, it's shocking. You know, yeah, it gets news coverage, but you know when it happens at the Jacksonville Landing on MLK Day, you know, these kind of random shootings or seemingly random shootings, then it's something that gets a lot of different coverage because it's high visibility, high profile. But you know, put in perspective, Miami had 8 people shot on Martin Luther King Day also. You know, so there, you know, there may be a larger trend that's happening that you know Jacksonville's just, you know, part of.
Let's go. Oh, go ahead, Andrew.
I was just gonna say, to be a little contrarian to Fred. I mean, I think it's easy to lose sight of the fact that we are an extremely historically safe city right now compared to where we were before. If you compare us to 1989 when we had a smaller population and 200 killings, now when we're a larger population and we have 110 killings, it's tragic, and we should mourn that. We should mourn the fact that 110 people or 115 people are dying of gun violence, but we shouldn't, I think, be so reactionary as to think that we are now in a historically crime-filled time period. And I think we should also remember there are always limitations. You could force everyone to have to go, you know, to a curfew, to be under constant police watch, just like you could end all traffic deaths if you said we're going to make the speed limit, you know, 5 miles per hour and you're only allowed to idle. I mean, there are limitations where we could make it more safer if we gave up more civil liberties. But are we willing to do that and say teens can't go downtown because they might bring violence?
Let's go to Linda in Deerwood quickly. Hi, Linda. Good morning.
Good morning. I just was wanting to say that one of the things, and maybe I missed this, is that we need to understand. I don't have a matrix to judge Sheriff Williams on, because when we were going through the election, 2 years ago, we heard we have 47 gangs. We have a gang task force. I'm assuming that most of the crimes and some of the crimes are from gangs or gang initiations. Yet I don't know what his initiative is on gangs. Are they feeding, money into that to focus on those individuals? Do they have the monitoring known gang members' Facebook feeds? We don't have a matrix, because I don't think during the election we demanded a plan. You know, Sheriff Williams is a nice guy. I just want him to come out and say, not saying it's probably gang related. I don't even want him to say that if he doesn't know it for sure, but saying if it is, we've got a task force that's investigating that, and we'll be bringing out our future plans to the thing. It's not that we have a lot of crime, but it's a lot of crime in new areas like Mandarin and Bay Meadows that normally we haven't seen, and I don't know that we have a handle on what the plan is to you know, bring that down. And that's all I had to say.
Thank you, Linda.
Yes, I mean, she makes a good point. There doesn't seem to be a lot of transparency from the sheriff's office right now.
I think what people want is they want to understand what is happening on a systemic level here. So when you say this was gang retaliation to what happened to Art Walk, if you can explain how you know that or explain a little bit about the structure of the gangs in Jacksonville to say, here's why this may have been retaliation or here's what we do know and just explain and here's what we don't know. So if you know something about this, please come forward.
And in the past, law enforcement agencies, not just in this city, but in other ones that I used to live in, they would be hesitant to talk about gang activity because they didn't want to legitimize the gangs and give them publicity. You know, there may be reasons for why the sheriff's office isn't talking in more detail about this, but at the same time, the public does want more information. That's clear.
And I think if that's the case, then the sheriff does owe a duty to say, here's why I'm not telling you more.
Well, and you're right, Melissa. I think that is one of the reasons why they didn't want to mention it, because they didn't want to legitimize it. But guess what? We're past that point now. Everybody, especially if you're in the Northwest side in zip code 7, 8, 9, and 11, and now 18, you know that they're there. You see them walking down the street. You see them on the corners. It's not just hanging on the corners anymore. You can see them there. Again, you can look at their Facebook feed, which is open to everybody, and you see who's in the gang, who isn't. You can see the threat about to happen before it happens. It's not a question anymore of trying to legitimize them. They want to be legitimized. It's a question of what are we going to do to stop this? And unfortunately, I say unfortunately, but the citizens in these areas are still looking for law enforcement to help them do it. And the way you do it is, of course, through infiltration. And the sheriff has got to come clear if he has a plan or doesn't have a plan to work this out.
But Fred, to your point earlier, when you were talking about how law enforcement can't stop crime before it happens, they come in after the fact. Even if they infiltrate gangs and they bring down gangs, what's to stop more gangs from coming up? I mean, I feel like this is more of a systemic infrastructure issue of where resources are going in this town.
I didn't say they couldn't stop it. I said that their job is not to prevent. Their job is to investigate and arrest.
But you could make the argument that the sheriff's office does try to prevent crimes with their Shadco organizations, getting out into the community, trying to do neighborhood walks.
Yeah.
I mean, that is part of the prevention piece.
Yeah.
Although I take your point.
You know, the whole thing that Williams and Curry talked about in the campaign 2 years ago was prevention, intervention, and enforcement. Jacksonville Journey was intended as a prevention program. You know, and we're not seeing immediate payoffs on this stuff. I mean, Curry and Williams both messaged as if we were in a public safety crisis. And, you know, they painted, you know, harrowing tales on the campaign trail. And guess what? You know, we're almost 2 years in, the murder rate's gone up, the high profile murder rate's gone up. And, you know, this is creating a perception problem. I mean, yeah, it's not as bad as it was 25 years ago. But the perception problem exists, and this is something that city leadership has no answer for. Jacksonville Journey is not going to do it. Jacksonville Journey is more of a long-term thing. So, you know, we're going to see through the rest of Lenny Curry's term, you know, a public safety crisis that if the Democrats run anybody, like, legitimate against him, they could exploit it very easily.
Okay, let's make note of a couple of other items from the week, including a couple of new bills moving in the Florida legislature. One has to do, it's from Audrey Gibson, making state attorney and public defender elections nonpartisan. There's an Amendment 2 bill from Rob Bradley, and Kim Daniels has a religious expression bill. AG Andrew, which of these has caught your eye?
The nonpartisan bill I wrote about. So this obviously came to the forefront of our mind with the state attorney and public defenders elections here. It happened in the reverse in Orlando. So in Jacksonville last year, unless you were a registered Republican, you could not vote in the state attorney or the public defender's election. In Orlando, if you were not a registered Democrat, you could not vote in the state attorney's election there. What this does is it's by Tracy Davis, who used to work at the Supervisor of Elections office, and it seeks to make those offices nonpartisan, which would mean all of the names are on the ballot at the same time in one fell swoop, and you vote on them just like you vote on the judges' races. It would expand it, and also the hope is by both Audrey Gibson and Tracy Davis is it would ensure the office is kept nonpartisan and people have to appeal to everyone else. There have been some concerns, especially by Republicans, that this deprives voters of critical information on the ballot. And there have been some compromises. Senator Bean and Senator Bradley have both said we could do something else like get rid of the write-in loophole, or we could do a sort of jungle primary like Jacksonville has, where everyone runs together and then the top two go to a runoff.
Hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if they can reconcile that on the Senate and House level this session, because a lot of proposals there are interesting, but you got to get to reconciliation.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the Bradley Amendment 2 bill, he's basically implementing the medical marijuana amendment. He's taking kind of a gradualist approach, you know, expanding the 2014 legislation that, you know, he pushed through using the compassionate use registry to, you know, register patients, caregivers, and doctors, you know, creating guidelines for to doctors so they don't prescribe to, you know, people who don't qualify under, you know, the constitutional amendment. You're going to see an alternative emerge to that. Jeff Brandis, another state senator's got one. He wants to expand the distributed network from the current seven to more, you know, more agencies that can actually produce marijuana and distribute it, sort of liberalize that. And he also wants to expand the list of conditions a little bit. So it's not, you know, just restricted, but also things like nausea, you know, spasms, seizures. So you're going to see that food fight in the Senate this year.
All right. And also one quick note, Jim Bailey, the publisher of the Financial News and Daily Record, announced this week he's selling the paper that's been in his family for a century. It has been sold to Daily Record and Observer LLC, a newly formed company headed by Florida publisher Matt Walsh. So just wanted to make note of that. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. And only in Florida does a man call 911 before he breaks into a house. The Village's News reports 27-year-old Jeffrey Dove called 911 as a concerned citizen, noting that his neighbor's house was unsecured. Deputies left, and then knowing the home was unlocked and the owner actually in the hospital, Dove just went back into the house and stole about $1,400 worth of items. Kind of sneaky and
now that's
crafty.
That's crime prevention.
Dove is now under arrest in a non-gilded cage. Only in Florida is a woman arrested for vehicle theft by leaving her teeth in the car. Mm. This is the ultimate Florida story. Police in Lady Lake were able to link Lindsay Jean Stanley McShane to a car theft when they found her dentures in the stolen vehicle. We're not sure if she used implant style or snap-in dentures. I hear the snap-in type is more popular among Florida's senior set.
She's
31.
I know. She's actually 31 years old and has dentures.
If you're going to commit a crime, just remember to keep the dentures in throughout the duration of the crime.
Sounds like her mouth was a meth.
That could be. Thank you, A.G. Gankarski, Fred Matthews, Claire Goforth, and Andrew Pantazzi. Again, the inauguration coverage of the president starts here on 89.9 at 11 a.m. Thanks. Have a great weekend, you guys.
See you on the other side. Yeah.
Thank you, Melissa.
And we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, this week's Friday News Roundup, a week that said goodbye to President 44.
This is a job of such magnitude that you can't do it by yourself.
And we'll swear in number 45.
That's what I do. I do a good job. You know, I mean, I know how to do this stuff. It will be repealed and replaced, and we'll know.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Starting next week, WJCT will expand its news talk programming later in the evening. You'll be able to enjoy Fresh Air with Terry Gross at 7, followed by a new talk show called Indivisible at 8. This call-in program is designed to bring Americans together Monday through Thursday for a national conversation during the first 100 days of the new Trump administration. On Fridays, we'll re-air the popular First Coast Connect Media Roundtable. For more details, visit wjct.org/changes.
Dave Brubeck comes to Jazz Night in America.
His legacy covers more than just music, just life.
The Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis perform the music of Dave Brubeck. I'm Christian McBride, and we're tipping our cap to a real ambassador. Hear the tunes you love reimagined for big band this week on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Clay County has a new sheriff to start off the new year. Daryl Daniels, a Navy veteran who served nearly 25 years with the JSO, is the first African-American to hold the sheriff's post in Clay County. He replaces the retiring Rick Beasler. Now, the new sheriff took office on January 3rd, and he's going to do his first community walk on Tuesday. Sheriff Daniels has already tapped former state attorney Angela Corey for his staff, and he says he'll explore a lot of new ideas, like equipping officers with body cameras. He joins us now with more about his goals for reducing crime in Clay County. Sheriff Daryl Daniels, a pleasure. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me here.
And congratulations. A big new office for you. As I mentioned, you're going to literally hit the ground running with a community walk next Tuesday.
Yes.
What's that going? How's that going to work?
Well, you know, in this country, we have, in my opinion, a gap between the community and law enforcement, and sometimes that gap manifests itself with in the spirit of mistrust or people looking at law enforcement questionably, mm-hmm. With the things that they see in the media. In Clay County, we enjoy a pretty good relationship with the community. However, I want to be more visible, me personally, and have members of the sheriff's office more visible and interacting more with the community. So the neighborhood walks and the other initiatives that will get off the ground are more than just meet and greets and skin and grin, handshaking, and hey, I'm the sheriff.
Yeah.
The real spirit behind interacting with the people is to get real-time intelligence from those folks who live in some of these communities that are experiencing some problems, and to find out from them what they think is going on.
What they think. And as you look at the county as a whole, what are your biggest concerns in terms of public safety?
Well, right now in Clay County, we're statistically experiencing a rash of crimes against property, auto burglaries. Yeah. And, typically those things have a nexus to narcotics activity. So we'll be stepping up our narcotics mm-hmm. enforcement in Clay County.
Clay County, in many respects, is a bedroom community, although
yes.
it's a changing county demographics wise. That's got to be a big part of what you're looking at, too, I would think.
Yes, yes. And so, you know, as we move forward with the expressway about to be coming through Clay County, as they near completion of the first phase and go into the second phase, that will bring more opportunity in Clay County. But, you know, for every positive thing like, opening up a roadway, then, you know, there's always some negative side. There's, you know, more opportunity for crime to be on the increase and some traffic related issues to be on the increase and those are things that you have to prepare for strategically. And in light of some of the things that are also going on in our neighboring counties, you know, what I hear a lot in Clay County is we don't want Clay County to be like some other county. And we want you as the sheriff to do everything mm-hmm. in your powers to keep our bedroom community.
Yeah.
And so really that's my priority, you know, as a longtime resident of Clay County, to make sure that we enjoy the quietness that people enjoy. Yes.
Now, you mentioned you're also concerned with strengthening trust in law enforcement. To that end, you might look at the idea of body cameras for your officers. That has become a huge issue, of course, around the country in recent years. Are you leaning toward implementing body cameras in Clay County?
So, you know, as the question was posed to me about the body cams, and it's certainly something that I'm willing to explore. However, currently I cannot support that budgetarily. Mm. But in the meantime, we've looked at grants that are out there, and there is a grant out there for body cams. So, you know, I tasked one of my staff members with exploring that grant and others to support that. But there is one specifically designed to get body cams into the sheriff's
office. Into the sheriff's office. Do you think that that would help in the sense of the transparency, the public feeling that your officers are being totally transparent about encounters, especially if something leads to an altercation or a police-involved shooting?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, and people, you know, they really want to be equipped with the information. And, you know, I say all the time, things happen, and sometimes good, sometimes bad. People understand life is life. But don't hide things as a sheriff's office, as a law enforcement office. Don't keep information from the citizens. And, you know, I spoke to a group this morning and reminded them of my personal philosophy that the sheriff's office and these police departments, they belong to the people. They belong to the citizens. And so, you know, as the chief law enforcement officer in the jurisdiction, I'm just basically the head guy in the law enforcement agency, but it's still the people's law enforcement agency. So, you know, you have to be forthcoming as an agency that belongs to the people.
Now, let me ask you as well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe you're only the second African-American sheriff in this area since Nat Glover served. He was the first African-American sheriff in the state of Florida since the Reconstruction period. Mm-hmm. So it's an historic moment for the First Coast as another officer of color ascends to a leadership position like this.
Yes.
That must be, that's a big deal. We just need to make mention of that.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't think that was, you know, why the voters voted for me.
Right.
But, you know, like I've mentioned in the past, it's just a byproduct of our reality. And, you know, as we move forward in time, you know, Clay County moves forward also. And I think that overall, Clay County has sent the strong message that, you know, any past thoughts that may have stigmatized Clay County, and we move beyond those stigmatizing biases.
Yeah. And in the meantime, people that haven't had a chance to meet you or get to know about you, you were just sworn in on January 3rd. You're going to be out walking on Tuesday. Where can people come see you and your fellow officers?
So we'll be out in the Tanglewood neighborhood in Orange Park on the 24th at 4:30 p.m. And it's not going to be the only walk. You know, there will be multiple walks. And so, you know, when you talk about neighborhood walks, it's not just the sheriff doing a walk. That's my walk. But my director will have his own walk. The chief of patrol will have his own walk. The lieutenants on the different shifts will have their walks. So this is just a prelude to things to come. And I'm modeling the behavior and modeling what I want my direct reports and those below them to do.
He is the new sheriff in Clay County. There's a new sheriff in town in Clay County. He is Daryl Daniels, the new chief law enforcement officer, just beginning the job. And thank you so much for driving up the road to see us.
Oh,
hope you'll come
it.
Back. Thanks for being
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for special Inauguration Day coverage of the incoming administration. We'll talk with science community leaders about what the future may hold for research and science policy under President Trump and a Republican-dominated Congress. From climate science to space to stem cells, the challenges to science in this new administration. On Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
You see them. Maybe at the office on the street, walking straight ahead, purposeful. Because they've got a plan. And on the next snap judgment, we find out what it is. Man on a mission. Snap judgment, storytelling of the beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, up in Georgia's Golden Isles, the sea has always been full of treasure. Whether it's the delicious shrimp and fish you catch or beautiful shells and shark teeth you find along the shore, the water is full of treasures. So on Jekyll Island, the tradition is continuing this year with their annual Island Treasures Glass Float Hunt. Jessica Scott is Marketing Communications Manager with the Jekyll Island Authority, and she's on the line. Jessica, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And this is such a neat tradition you do on Jekyll. Fishermen used to use these glass floats on their nets, and sometimes they'd wash ashore. Beachcombers would pick them up. So now you kind of hide these glass floats in plain sight all around the island. People are trying to find them. This is going on now, correct?
That's right. It actually started January 1st, and our beach buddies, that's what we've given the folks who hide the floats, that's their name, the beach buddies hide anywhere from 2 to 5 floats every single day in January and February. And on the weekends, which Friday is considered part of the weekend, so Friday through Sunday, they hide double the number. So it could be 4 to 10.
So people need to go out today through the weekend. They'll have better luck.
Absolutely. And this weekend on Saturday, this Saturday is one of the select Saturdays that we are adding 3 additional floats in the beach village. If you've not been up since we finished it, the beach village is a beautiful shopping and dining area right on the ocean here on Jekyll. And so we thought people will be out. They'll be enjoying the day. We're going to hide some extra floats. So we convinced the beach buddies to do it on the 21st of January, the 28th of January, the 4th of February, and an additional one on the last weekend on the 25th of February.
Okay, so people have some time to find these, and they're beautifully painted by local artists, I need to also point out. They're really beautiful commemorative items, and they are hidden in plain sight anywhere on the island. So anywhere people go walking through the beautiful Barrier Island, they might see one of these.
Absolutely. It really is all about just enjoying the island itself and finding that extra treasure. Beach buddies always hide things out in plain sight, never on private property, never in the sand dunes, never in an animal habitat. It's always a safe place that's really just right in plain sight. You just have to keep your eyes open for them.
All right. Get out. Happy hunting, everyone. Jessica Scott with Jekyll Island Authority, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great weekend.
You too. Finally this hour, it's a magical tale that reveals the origins of Peter Pan, Wendy, the Lost Boys, Captain Hook, and a far-off place known as Neverland. In the new production at Theater Jacks, a young orphan and his mates are shipped off from Victorian England to a distant island ruled by an evil king. And the plot goes from there. The winner of 5 Tony Awards, Peter and the Starcatcher, is on stage now. Al Emmerich and Ron Shreve, 2 of the cast members, are here to tell us more. Hey, guys, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So this reveals the mystery of Neverland. This sounds like a great show to take kids to take the whole family to. What happens on stage?
It's absolutely a family show. I would say I equate it to like The Wizard of Oz. You have Kansas, the Twister,
and then Oz. We just go straight for the Twister and then into Oz. There's no Kansas in our show.
Okay, so Al Emmerich, who do you play in the show?
I play the role of Black Stash, which is the precursor to Captain Hook.
Okay.
And
make an excellent pirate.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely. Do you have a big wig? And
no, he has a big, big, big mustache.
Oh, yes. You've got an evil mustache.
Yes.
I love it.
He has been known for many a days at sea for his Black Stash. And then, of course, throughout the show, you find, amongst other things, how he became Captain Hook.
Okay. And Ron, you're also education director at Theater Jax. I need to point out, who do you play?
I play Peter Pan.
You're Peter. Okay. Yes. You're Peter Pan.
Yes.
So the starring role, how is this different than the typical tale we know of when we think of Peter Pan?
Oh, it's absolutely different. And that's one of the things people coming to this show should expect. You're not going to see anything until later on in the show, any inkling of the actual story. This is totally new.
It's all the precursor. It's everything you said, well, how did, and that's actually how the story came to be. Is, you know, the author's daughter said, hey, listen, how did Peter Pan come to be? And
so this is the backstory.
Totally the backstory.
And how exciting is that?
So the imagination is wide open.
Now you've started shows. What's the reaction been?
It's been fantastic. You know, I think we've all done a number of shows, but what's so special about this experience is that people keep telling us from the audience, you all on stage look like you're having a great time, which sometimes you don't get that experience. In this case, we really truly are having an absolute blast.
But the run is limited. People need to get their tickets now. How many more shows of Peter and the Starcatcher?
We have this weekend and then the following weekend, and then we're done.
And there are matinee performances on Sunday, too, and it is totally appropriate for the family. But also, if you're not a big theater fan, per se, you're like, oh, I wouldn't want to go to... This is really 2 hours of a suspension of belief that takes you on a joyride. It's like going to a theme park, somebody told me once. So.
It's definitely, people need laughter right now, and this is a really great place to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so go catch some wonderful local theater at the longest running community theater in the state of Florida, Theater Jacksonville in the San Marcos Square. It's Peter and the Starcatcher on stage now, the winner of 5 Tony Awards, shows this weekend and next only. Get your tickets now at theaterjax.com. Ron Shreve and Al Emmerich, both stars of this production. Guys, break a leg, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. The show's producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchik. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. In 1 hour, 89.9 will carry live coverage of the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump. Tune in for that. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.